Welcome everybody to episode 12 in the Golden Arrows series, looking back at the history of the BDO World Championship. And I'm delighted to be joined today by one of the sport's all-time legends, the three-time world champion, Old Stoneface himself, Mr. John Lowe. How are you, John?
I'm fine, thank you.
And I mean, we're almost at the end of it now, but how have the last sort of 3-4 months, the coronavirus lockdown, been for yourself?
Very different. I'm like everyone else, I suppose. Well, I'm not. I mean, I was on the road all the time, travelling, doing exhibitions, presentations, promotions, and all that came to a stop on the 20th of March. And a new world began where I've stayed on, basically, for 3 or 4 months, and just gone out to shop like anyone else. And I suppose now we're just getting back to some sort of normality, if we can call it that.
And have you thrown many darts at all?
Not as many as I probably should. I'm a big believer that to get rid of all bad habits, you stop doing something and you go back to basics when you start again. So I literally enjoyed having 2 or 3 months off without playing darts every day. Mm. So now when I do start again, I can sort of go back to maybe 20, 30 years ago and start from basics.
Mm. And I guess before we get started chatting about your career, you recently made some traction on social media with your hand sanitizer. I mean, what was the thinking there?
The thinking came from someone else. It wasn't my idea. It was someone who already is involved in sanitizers with Fruiter.
Mm.
And the table has to be sanitized after every frame. And it's quite realistic that the dartboard's the same, because you touch the dartboard every time you fetch your darts out, retrieve them. It's impossible not to. And so if there's a lot of people playing matches for social reasons, one after the other, it will leave, or may leave, we don't know, may leave an infection on the board. So it has to be sanitised.
Mm.
It caused a reaction because it was seen that my face was on there and it looked like I was making money from launching something from this terrible disease. But in all honesty, it has to be done. The atomizer spray, which is they're quite expensive because everybody in the world wants it right now. And the nozzle has to be such that when you spray, it doesn't come out in a direct line. It has to be as wide as possible. So literally 2 sprays will cover an old dartboard, which makes it cost effective.
Looking at your darting career, how was it that you actually got started?
Probably fate. I didn't throw a dart, literally, until I was 21. I didn't start when I was young. Like anyone else, probably my mother, father bought me a paper dartboard when I was a kid, and I probably threw a few darts on that, and then never bothered again. I'm from a very religious family, so sort of going to pubs and that was out with the old family until I got to an age where I could make my own decision. And I started racing motorcycles. That's where this all began, and it was actually snowing one Good Friday. I was going to Oldham Park with a racetrack, and it was too bad. Came back, called in a pub called the Butcher's Arms at Brimington, and some guys were playing darts. One went to the toilet, asked me to take his throw, and I take his throw for him. And it all began that day.
Did you feel that you had like a natural affinity and ability for the sport, or did it take, years of practice and so on?
No, what really happened, I never thought I'd play darts again. But the guy left. He said, oh, you're doing all right, you're better than me. And he left with an old set of brass darts, which we don't use brass anymore. And he left and left me his darts, so I carried on playing. And then I got a set at home. And just played for social. I was a carpenter and got a decent business. And I sort of just started playing at home for fun. Then they asked me to join the local league and it snowballed. And before I knew where I was within a year, I was playing 7 days a week.
And I guess your first notable win was the British Pentathlon, which you went on to win 10 times in all. And then the World Masters later that year. Talk me through that World Masters victory and what it meant to you at the time.
Masters was absolutely fabulous, but before that was the News of the World, which was the World Championship. That was the biggest competition in darts, and I won that. That was the really first major trophy that I could really say that that I won. But the World Masters was a World Championship, because it had the name World on it. And with that sort of boosted me, it made me believe I was as good as anybody else, if not better. And that's really, really what you need to believe to succeed, to carry on.
You mentioned the news of the world there. You did actually go on to win that in 1981. I mean, why was that tournament so special to yourself and countless others from that era who speak of it so fondly?
The News of Wales was the only tournament that every single person in this country could enter. To win the World Masters, you have to play Super League. You have to qualify through Super League to play for your county. And win your county to go forward to the World Finals, wherever they may be. The News of the World, all you had to do was fill that little form in the newspaper, go to your local pub and have a playoff to decide the winner, and you competed against literally hundreds of thousands of people. So it was the hardest tournament to win. It was only put out to England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and then they allowed America in, and for some unknown reason, Sweden. I never did understand that, but they were the only country, so it wasn't truly representative worldwide, but it was by far the biggest competition and the biggest trophy.
And I guess the format as well, the best of three legs all the way through, made it particularly challenging as well.
Oh, yes, and also the throw was from 8 feet. The throw now is 7 feet. 9 3/4, so 3 inches longer than this throw. And in those days, the local throw in most clubs in Great Britain would be 9 feet from the bullseye to the floor, which is only 7 feet 1. So it's actually 11 inches longer. It was very difficult to play in it.
You mentioned, obviously, the News of the World didn't encompass the entire world. You were there for the first World Championship in 1978. What was the atmosphere like going into that tournament, with obviously being the first one that had been a Darts World Championship?
It was quite unbelievable. It was obviously the... everybody thinks it was the BDO and Ollie Croft that brought that about, but that's not true. The actual guy that brought it all about was Michael Watterson from Chesterfield, who put together the World Snooker Championships with Embassy. And that's how it became. He rang me at 2 o'clock in the morning and asked me, he said, how many professionals are there in darts? I said, about 4. He said, well, we need at least 16. I'm putting a world championship on. And that's how it all started. By the time we got to Nottingham, where the first one was held, they put together players from America, Australia. And so they made it a truly world championship by bringing in the best player from each country to play there.
And you missed that in the final that year, which is obviously the only year that the final was played in a legs format rather than a set play format. But 1979, you went to the new venue, Jolly's in Stoke. You know, I mean, before we look at that tournament in detail, how did the three venues, Lakeside, Jolly's and the Heart of the Midlands Club, how did they compare?
The Heart of the Midlands was small in comparison to Jolly's. And likewise, Jolly's was small compared to the venues of today. But Jolly's was a great venue. It was a typical old-fashioned semi-circular nightclub, and a great viewing. And it sort of went upwards towards the back slightly, where the Talk of the Midlands, sort of the one in Nottingham, was basically just a room with a stage. Jolly's was a great advance and a very good venue.
And I mean, that first year that they were there, 1979, you obviously won the final, actually beating Leighton Rees in it, and a rematch of the year before. What was the moment like when the winning double went in?
It was fabulous. There's a lot of stories about that final where we used to play so many sets in the afternoon, 3 sets in the afternoon, and then have a break and then come back at night. And I was 3-0 up. I was beating Leighton convincingly. And Embassy came up to me and asked me literally, would I throw a set to let Leighton back into the game? I said, you don't know that in World Championships, because before you know where you are, confidence goes up and I'll be on the end of a loser. I've got some great stories from Jolly's, and I mean, Leighton were the best of friends. I couldn't wish for a nicer guy to play on stage and Miss with him, probably.
1980, obviously, Eric Bristow won his first world championship. In 81, you played Eric in the final and came up short. But, I mean, you two had some great battles over the years, especially in major finals. What was he like as an opponent?
Great opponent. Absolutely brilliant opponent. Great dart player. That final, again, I was winning quite easily when that match started. And I went down with a virus halfway through. Terrible wash, temperature of about 38, sweating really bad, and they wanted to call the doctor, and I said, no, it's pretty long. And I would remember Eric after that final in his interview on TV, and he said, that's not the John I know. And I was respecting him for that, you know, ever since. And then we played, obviously, together well, pairs all over the world together. Terrific pairs partnership. Although he looked in newspapers that we fell out a few times, it was really just typical of newspapers today, just basically hype.
Am I right in when you travelled abroad for tournaments, you actually split the prize money?
Yes, we did split prize money when we went abroad for the simple reason there wasn't enough of it. So me and Eric knew in particular one of us would probably get to the final, which we did for something like 17 years. One of us was in the embassy final for 11 years in a row, which is quite incredible. And we shared prize money in every event right up until the 10th of October 1984, when his manager told him that he was a better player than me and not to split anymore because he was only getting half of his 15%. And what happened 4 days later, I did the $9 game on TV, and technically, or what really happened, Eric lost out on £50,000.
I mean, it's funny how those things work out. And I guess, I mean, the nine data was the next thing I wanted to ask you about. I mean, that is one of the sport's, you know, most iconic moments. That actually happened in the quarterfinal game against Keith Deller. Obviously, the emotional buzz after getting that in. How did you sort of refocus yourself for then the remaining games of the tournament, which you then went on to win the whole thing?
I think, to be honest, after that nine data game, after I'd done it on TV, I think that's when I realised I was a good dart player. After all the years, 19 years, I practised to do that. And when it happened, I didn't know what the reaction was going to be, but my first instinct was, now I've got to beat Keith, and then I've got to win the tournament. So I'm forever going to say, what a lucky guy for 2.5 minutes. And so my intention then was, beat Keith, win that tournament. And that was... That's when I, after winning it, that's when I thought to myself, you're not a bad dart player at all.
And I guess that moment of that nine data has been replayed so many times over the years. That must be one of your proudest achievements.
It was. I never used to class it as the biggest. It's gone over 1.2 million on YouTube now. Different people have put it on. But I was speaking to a Formula One motor racer a few years ago, and he said to me, that must be the biggest achievement in your life. I said, well, not really. I said, winning the world championship is. What about you at motor racing? And he said, oh, no, he said, pole position is the biggest thing you can do in motor racing. That's the fastest lap. And I thought, oh, so maybe I'll change my thinking. And after all these years later, it is the nine dart game that's kept me there more than winning a world champion. People always relate the first one that ever did it.
Watching that nine dart clip back, I think one of the things I've always taken from it is your throw and how you throw with so much poise and patience, and you've got quite a slow, methodical throw. And I know Bob Anderson said before that if anyone wanted to watch a player to learn how to throw darts properly, they should watch you. How did your throw develop over the years?
I was a little weird. Right from the start, I always thought, how do you make these things work without any effort? That was... It's like being a carpenter. If you draw a line on a piece of wood, you cut with your saw and leave the line. So it's intense. You don't take that line off. It shouldn't be left there when you finish cutting, so it's the exact size that you measured. And so I thought, how do I get a dart to go exactly where I'm throwing it? And so I worked on pulling the elbow in and making it easy thrower. And I think that's the reason I'm still playing at 74, which is longevity in its in its best, I suppose. And that's because I've made sure I don't put strain on my back, I don't put strain on my legs. I just stand there in a correct way and throw the dart. And I think that it not developed. I think I was probably a better player when I was 22 than what I am now. So the style may have altered a little.
I mean, you appeared at the time a record 28 consecutive world championships. Was it that, you know, the throw and putting, you know, minimal strain on your body? Do you think that was the main key to that longevity?
That coupled with I've been blessed with good eyesight. I still don't wear glasses now. I can do the crossword in a newspaper. And yet my sister, all the family, they all wore glasses. So I'm a little bit blessed there. I think good eyesight is very important. Not just for darts, but for all sport. And for me, I know we only throw from 7'9", but there is a difference, that sharpness in the eye. I keep that style. That's why it's nice to look back at the nine dart game on YouTube or whatever, and just say, hey, that's what I did. Now I'm back to get back to that style.
Looking back at the World Championship, your second world title win came in 1987. And I mean, if you look purely at the numbers, which can often be misleading in darts, but if you look purely at the numbers, that was your strongest year at Lakeside. You came within a hair's breadth of getting a 100 average against Dave Lee, and then that final with Eric Bristow, again, another great game that you eventually won 6-4. What are your memories of that year?
A great year. I was, to be honest, right from the start of that tournament, inside, I said, this is how I'm going to win it. And I was hoping on all odds that I'd meet Eric in the final. To me, Eric was the best player together. So to get the one and two in the final and win, that's really makes it all worthwhile.
Do you think that was the best you've ever played at a World Championship that year?
It's an odd one to say because you only play as good as your opponent. So if your opponent puts a really good show up, you have to play better to beat him. Obviously, you need a little bit of luck. You may miss a few doubles, and you may get a few doubles. That's sport all over. But I would say that race from possibly playing the first round to the final, yes, probably the best.
And then the final title came for you in 1993 when you beat Alan Warriner. I mean, what was the atmosphere at that tournament like? Because obviously you were part of the group that, you know, had already kind of planned to split from the BDO, and I know some of you were wearing the WDC patches at the tournament. So, I mean, what was that atmosphere like?
The atmosphere was a little tense. Not on stage. The audience didn't care about the next, what was going to happen next. All they cared about was coming to Lakeside and enjoying the dart, so they were great. But the strange thing with Ollie Croft of the BDO and the Red Jacket Brigade who told them, and the players, and that would show itself in the hospitality room more than anywhere else. I would remember taking the coffee that night for the embassy sort of final presentation with food and what have you, and I actually stood up and said, I'm the champion, but I may not be back next year to defend it. And that, of course, did the BDO, and didn't really like that at all.
And why did you feel that it was the time to split? Was it the decline in the number of television tournaments?
Yes, we had, it was necessary not to split. We didn't want to split. That was forced on us, but we wanted the BDO to listen. The players had become quite powerful, I would say. There was been good money, decent money going around with the world doing exhibitions and promotions for companies. And so they wanted to say, but the BDO, they just wouldn't listen. And so it became, we've got to go, we were losing, we were down to one event on TV, the World Championship, plus the World Masters, and that was gradually fading away. So we, as a sport, it was going backwards.
And what was your personal relationship like with Ollie Croft?
The relationship in that final was very tense. Not from all the BDO officials, but Ollie ran the BDO as if it was his. He set it up, and everyone else just had to do what Ollie said, not the players, the officials as well. And of course, there were plenty of officials that went along with that. They thought Ollie was some god. I mean, he did a great job. We're not going to take that away from him. But if he'd have sat with us and spoken, the BDO would today probably be where the PDC are. Whether they'd have been as efficient and money productive, I don't know. But they would certainly have been still mega worldwide. And I read last week that the actual commercial arm of the British Guards organisation went into liquidation this week.
Hmm. And was that, when you read that, was that a sad day for you?
Possibly. I didn't know that it said the commercial arm of the BDO and not the actual structure of the counties themselves. But it looks like there's a split now within the counties, and they're forming the three separate bodies where there's only one original one. So things are not good at the moment.
Definitely. And before, you know, we address the split, which obviously is one of the most historically important moments in the sport, there are a couple of areas that I wanted to talk about. Last weekend, sort of the talk of the darting world was the return of Bullseye to our television screens. What did you make of it?
I thought it was great. Actually, I thought it set off really slow. But that was down to the dart player actually not being very good. But when it picked up and they put the three revolving boards out at the end, I thought that was a great idea. And rightly so, the people that won it did well because they were just targets got smaller and smaller. I thought it was really good on TV. And I understand the vote between all those epic game shows, Bullseye came out of the top.
I certainly thoroughly enjoyed it. And I was actually watching an old episode of Bullseye last night, and you were the professional player throwing for charity. I mean, what was it like going on that show, you know, when it was at its, you know, its peak in the 80s?
Bullseye was not quite what you saw on the TV. I mean, I did the two pilot shows for it, which were absolutely, I wish they'd have kept them better than the actual thing. Jim Bowden was all over the place. He didn't know what he was doing. It was really fun. But what they did wrong, the revolving board, when he turns around from the dartboard and they spin it around and on the back, his bullet star prize board, they built it, and then they decided he'd got to put it on a turntable to turn it round. And the turntable was 3 inches deep, so the actual bullseye, the board itself, was 3 inches high. I mean, when I threw for charity, I noticed it straight away. I saw him move forward 6 inches on the floor, and no one bothered. But the contestants, right through Bullseye, 13, 14 years of it,
Wow, I didn't know that. Looking back, I know when Bullseye was at its height, it had huge viewership. I mean, what would you say, as someone who, you know, who was around at that time and, you know, playing your best darts, what would you say the show's cultural impact was on society?
I think just as a game show, everybody loved it. I mean, in those days, we had something like 7 million social players in pubs and clubs. We never wanted to be any better than just having a game of darts. And so it appealed to them. The prizes were quite rubbish, and that made it good as well. And the speedboat became absolutely... Everyone spoke about a speedboat on Bully. It was, to me, it was... If I remember, I think the viewing figures were around 17 million a week. But they couldn't play for Scotland because they put it on at a different time to the rest of us. But it was great. And to bring it back, if you remember, they brought it back with, I forget his name, Spike, I think they called him. And it wasn't the same. It wasn't the same without Jim Bowden.
And I guess another less good kind of, you know, darts on society thing was, you know, in the 80s, there was that Not the 9 o'clock News sketch where they very much tried to sort of, you know, mock the sport and the presence of alcohol within the sport. I mean, what are your memories of, you know, when that sketch was aired, and what was your reaction to it?
My reaction to it, to be honest, I thought it was quite funny. I took it as it was meant to be. I didn't think it was a knock at us. I thought it was just a general look at darts, and in all honesty, it was exactly like what they did. People used to turn around after every throw and pick a drink up and have a drink. It was in the pubs and the clubs of Great Britain. Darts wasn't anything else, it was a pub game. Of course, it's all changed now, but a lot of people tried to say that it was wrong, but I thought it was quite a bit of fun and took it as it was.
In 1988, I think it was, alcohol was removed from sort of televised stage games. What was your reaction to that decision?
It didn't really bother me at all. They actually removed smoking just before it. And that did bother me, because I used to stand up on stage. People did smoke while they were playing, and I'm a smoker in life, but I used to go up there with red eyes, and people used to say, "Oh, you're smoking." I said, "I don't smoke." I didn't mind anyone that does. That's their choice. But when they stop the drinking, it's a bit like now. You don't see a drink, and that's the word, you don't see. But they can, in the break, they can have a drink when they go backstage if they want one, although they've not got long. But when there's a commercial break on TV, the drink there for the players if they want one.
So going back to the split in 1993, what were those first few months like? And did you ever worry that, you know, it had all sort of collapsed around you?
When the split came, which we never thought it would, when it did happen, the first thing the BDO did was to actually ban us from taking part in all those competitions run by them. All of a sudden, we'd gone from paid counties, like I played for Derbyshire at that time, and I couldn't play for them. And also, I couldn't even go to the venue. So what they did, the livelihood that we had, they took it away from us. It was a threat to all officials that if they were to book us for an exhibition and run it, they would also be banned as well. And that lasted 2 years. That was a long time.
Was there a worry that the whole, you know, that the World Darts Council would fail when, you know, Chris Johns and Mike Gregory kind of went back to the BDO?
When Sky approached us, we didn't have 32 players. We actually made the numbers up to 20. I know it's an odd number, but to play at the Circus Tavern that first year, we actually did a round robin to make sure that we got enough gainers in for the TV. The guy who ran Sky Sports, who had gone from the BBC for many years, when Chrissy Jones and Mike Gregory went back to the BDO, he circulated all the other players within that tournament and said, "One more player leaves, and we pull the plug." So we were very close to never having what is now the PDC. We were very close up for it not being taken place. And the BDO would have won, and we'd have been either finished playing darts or had to go back and eat on a bump by.
What was your relationship like with Chris and Mike after they left? Did you keep in touch with them at all?
I've never seen Chrissy Jones from that day. But that's really strange. I don't know what happened to Chris. He was a nice guy. And, he just sort of disappeared. Didn't play county. And didn't take part in anything. Because what they did, they invited him back to the BDO. And then I never picked him for anything in Wales. So in one way, he tried to make the break all the players standing together, which they succeeded with him. Mm. But he never actually progressed after that. Mike Gregory, I didn't like what he did. He made a lot of the stories up that he said he'd lose his house and he'd lose his car. That would never have happened. And so, because when we did go to court against the media, we went collectively with the backers, so we would never have lost anything.
Looking at your career in the WDC PDC, you're never able to lift another world championship. You got to two world championship semis and two semis at the world match play. But what was the highlight of that portion of your career?
It was great. It was the sort of the coming towards the end of competing professionally, because although I enjoyed it, I enjoyed the walk-ons that they introduced, and everything was slightly different. It was the same competition. It wasn't the same players, because some of them decided the grass was greener on the BDO side, and it was easier to win the late side than come and play with the real top guys. But I enjoyed it, and I've competed in it for a long time, and then I was travelling around the world. I thought, this has got to stop. I'll just go on to exhibitions and promotions, which I still do it. I enjoyed the PDC, but when it was time to go,
one of the other, standout elements of your career was, during your stint in the BDO, was your time as England captain. You know, you spent 7 years as England captain. You were undefeated for that time. And across your international career, I think it was 23 titles you picked up. I mean, do you remember that the day when you got called up to play for England the first time?
Yes, I remember playing for England the first time very well. It was in London. Eric also played that day, Cliff Lazarenko, and we became really good friends. Billy Leonard, he was there as a world champion for that very first time. I was around the playing because they're using big blue and white trousers on. And we were far better than any other team. The reason England, I know I was captain and the team was unbeaten for that 7 years, but England had a tremendous star team. Any captain, I think, would have been part of that winning side for all those years.
During that time, in, you know, playing for England, you won titles in New Zealand, Canada, Finland, Australia, you know, the Netherlands. What were some of the standout highlight moments for you while playing for England?
There's a lot to beat the Scots. You know, whenever you play the Scotland, the place was full to the rafters and hostilities were unbelievable. I mean, when I was trying to pick the trophy up when I'd beat them, I would say to Eric, you come in last. I didn't want him inside of me because he'd be throwing ashtrays at him. That's how it was. He expected that. And yet, whenever I play exhibitions in Scotland, they think the world of me. It's great. I love going to the place, but they were fierce competitors. I mean, we went to the Island Games and I had to play jockey. And I beat jockey there, and then in New Zealand, I beat jockey in the final in New Zealand. But it's surprising how many Scotsmen have travelled all around the world. They seem to be everywhere. and they support the rock, which is great.
You mentioned Jockey Wilson there. I know last year BBC Scotland released the documentary they'd done on, you know, his career and, you know, the way things ended for him. And you were part of that documentary. I mean, what was your relationship like with Jockey, you know, while you were both playing?
Myself and Jockey always got on well. He would always talk to me, Jockey, when he was dressed with a blazer and a Scottish tie on. And he'd come up to me and he'd say, "How am I doing?" And I said, "What do you mean, Jockey? Do I look okay?" And he always just asked me. Me and Jockey never really ever fell out. Hmm. It was a matter of the fierce Scotsman always wanted to beat the English. You know, it was a pride thing, which seems to run through Scotland. And he was, as I said in the interview, he was a very, very insecure person. He'd be a different fella when he'd lost to what he was when he was winning. He was Jockey, and people still remember him. I played on the 5th of December this year at Alloway Town Hall, and it's the Jockey Wilson Cup. And I'm playing for England against Scotland, which is great to be able to get back. You know, hopefully that'll be allowed by then to have the big crowds in the venues.
I guess one of the, you know, competition element I wanted to touch on was 2004. You know, there was the showdown game arranged between Phil Taylor and Andy Fordham. And I know on the undercard, as it were, of that broadcast, you actually played Eric Bristow. I mean, what was that whole occasion like? Because it was really the only thing of its kind, really, until, you know, they brought in the Grand Slam.
It was actually the PDC, Barry Earn. It was one of Barry Earn's first promotions within Dart before he became chairman of the PDC and also a major shareholder. That was one of his promotions that he put on the Sky, and it was great. Unfortunately, halfway through, Andy took very ill and they had to take him off to hospital, so it didn't quite come out like it should. But it was a good promotion, and we were looking to do it again, but it never really came off again.
I know watching the game between you and Eric back, you definitely didn't play your best darts that day, but you both looked like you had a real whale of a time and having a good laugh and joke on the stage.
Sadly, we did that day, and you're right. I didn't play my best, and I think I was too nice with Eric that day. We were actually sponsored by the same company, Volkswagen Sponsors, which I got the sponsorship for a pair of us. And in my own way, it was up there doing that. It was a bit like a McEnroe versus Bill thing. It would have been better done as an exhibition rather than a contract.
And obviously, you know, you were part of the League of Legends series that was run sort of 2007, 2008. Obviously, never really progressed from there. But do you think there's a market today for that kind of thing?
The League of Legends carried on. Unfortunately, the TV company went bankrupt. That was really the setback. The sponsor, if I remember, was Betfred. And they wanted to continue. They could see there was a good market for it. And then, of course, I see it resurrecting, probably not with the same players, but I think there's a market there now. Phil Taylor and Bonavon Bell no longer playing the PDC, but are still being drawn around the world. So I can see a readiness tour coming up with those two as the headliners and inviting a few others in. And if I get an invite, I'd probably play the first season. And I can see it happening. I really can. It's just a matter of now everything's been set back for a year with this COVID. Everything stopped within it. I think it'll be at least a year before things get back to some sort of normal.
The last thing I want to really touch on with you, you know, you were awarded the MBE. What was your response when you found out that you were going to be awarded it?
When I got the letter that came through asking me if I'd accept it, that's the nice thing, that you don't just say we're giving you an MBE. You actually get a letter from the Chancery signed by Elizabeth on the letter, actually saying, would you accept it? You know, I found that really nice because a lot of people did turn them down. To get it, it was an unbelievable a moment, and the occasion going to Buckingham Palace probably ranks bigger than the Night Dart game.
And would you say that's probably the kind of the icing on the cake for your whole career, really?
I think it wasn't just given for darts, but when I was there, it was given for charity work as well. But when Prince Andrew, I had a chat with him when he presented me with it, and the last thing he said to me is he shook my hand, he said, I trust that you'll accept this on behalf of darts and not the charity. He said that to me. In other words, he must have watched quite a lot and he must have thought, it's good for the recognition for the sport.
You know, looking back on your career, what would you say is, you know, your favourite memory or the thing that stands out to you most?
I've got some great memories. A lot of them in America. I've visited America a lot. I've been to Las Vegas 51 times, which is quite a lot. I've played darts and probably America over 200. And I found the great people. It's the best country that I've actually played in with the response. So I've got memories there. But the Night Dart game, obviously, is a great memory. And then to drive my car through the gates of Buckingham Palace, I think that probably right up there with the best.
Been an absolute pleasure talking to you today, John. You are one of the greatest players the sport's ever seen, and certainly someone who, you know, I like watching back your games and certainly trying to pick up stuff from your throw that can improve, you know, the low quality efforts I'm able to produce. But it's been a pleasure talking to you today, John.
Thank you very much.